when there's a crime in the street, the first thing the cops look for is a motive. In the case of the International Crimes Against Humanity, which took place September 11th, 2001 in New York, Washington, Pennsylvania, I think the one question why we were not really allowed to ask. We were told by the president and by the newspapers that this is because the killers hated democracy, or because they hated good people, or because they were the forces of darkness and it was good against evil. And I don't think this is sufficient. These people came from an area of the world, the Middle East. And it's important to look into the history and the policies of the Middle East and our Western policies and American policies towards the Middle East to try and find how this society could produce people who did things like this. They didn't just get up in the morning and say, you know, let's commit acts of mass murder. We know that. And we know it was planned. But how could they do it? And how could it be that such an appalling, catastrophic act could be carried out against America? I think that we have to look into the history of the Middle East. We need to look at how the Arabs and Israelis have been treated by the West. We have to look, I'm sorry to say, at America's policies towards the Middle East, its unconditional support for Israel, and its acceptance that the occupation continues, even though they'd, I'm sure, like a peace. We have to look at why so many Arab countries have dictators who are basically our Western dictators, appointed by us and supported by us, even though they use secret policemen and torture chambers. And that includes Egypt, by the way, as well as the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia. We have to ask ourselves, I think, why so many countries in the Middle East have American troops or military personnel based there. Americans are in Turkey. Americans are in Jordan. They're in Egypt. They're in Saudi Arabia. They're in Kuwait. They're in Bahrain. They're in Qatar. They're in the United Arab Emirates. They're in Oman. They may soon be in Iraq. They tried to get into Lebanon, but of course in 1983 there was the truck bomb and they left. They tried Somalia, which didn't work. But there's almost a complete ring running right through the Middle East of American bases. In fact, if you go north, it stretches all the way up to Iceland, doesn't it? Because the Americans are above Turkey, the Americans are in Greece, they're in Kosovo, they're in Bosnia, they're in Germany, they're in Britain, they're in Iceland, Greenland. There's a huge wall there. I'm not saying that this is directly to do with September 11, but we need to look at why American troops in such numbers are in the Middle East. We need to look at the question of oil. We also need to ask, for example, why we're really keen on such an invasion of Iraq, if we are keen on that invasion. I mean, the administration might be. I get the impression that an awful lot of Americans may not be, but that's a different matter.
I see that's turning in the latest polls
It's starting to turn. And I think more and more the word oil comes to be associated with invasion of Iraq.
Just so I have you straight, though, you're not blaming this on America, right? You just think there should be a more formal examination of everything. Do I have you right there?
Look, the acts, the international acts against humanity, these were crimes on a massive scale that occurred, and they were carried out by Arabs, 15 of whom were Saudis, one was Lebanese, one was Egyptian. We know the identities. We know that these people called themselves Muslims, whether we would call them Muslims is a different matter. They believed they were. I think that the causes of this go right back to the period of the British and French mandates after the First World War. You see, this is a part of the world that has been lied to over and over again. All sides have been lied to. Remember, during the First World War, the British gave their support for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Not part of Palestine. They said Palestine. Mm-hmm. Not just the bit that's Israel now. They said they were referring to all of Palestine. Mm-hmm. At the very same time, Lawrence of Arabia was wandering around the deserts of Arabia, promising the Arabs independence for the whole Arab world if they supported the British and the French in the Middle East. Mm. So we gave conflicting promises to the two sides in the Middle East, and promises are meant to be kept. And of course, we broke both. Now, we started off, therefore, in the aftermath of the First World War, in a situation where the West, who were the victors, my father was a soldier in the First World War. He was much older than my mother. He was 19 in 1918, Second Lieutenant Bill Fisk in the Third Battle of the Somme. So it's his, and by the way, I have his campaign medals, and on the back of it, it says, from the First War, the Great War for Civilization. It's not President Bush's idea that this is about civilization. We thought we were fighting. My dad thought he was fighting a war for civilization back then. So I believe that we all live under the sort of malign influence of history. And if you come forward from that and you come up to the Second World War, and then, of course, the creation of the State of Israel, the dispossession of the Palestinians in the state which was becoming Israel, and that part of Palestine that became Israel, and then we see, particularly after 1967, certainly the world's only free superpower. Russia was definitely not a free superpower. It was a very unfree one. began more and more to favor one side in the Middle East, which was the State of Israel. And after 67, once the settlement building began on Arab land, settlements for Jews and Jews only, America became seen within the Middle East as being an ally of Israel rather than a friend of the Arabs. It kept saying it was a friend of the Arabs. And of course, it managed when Egypt made peace with Israel, it started bailing out Egypt billions of dollars a year to keep it afloat, to the point where President Mubarak cannot possibly do anything to offend America, because if he lost the money, that's the end of Egypt. The economy collapses at once. At the same time, it developed these relations with the Arab Gulf states, states which are run by monarchies, which might be more suitable to the 15th century in the way they treat their own people and have forms of execution. I mean, I'm against all form of execution anyway. But therefore, we see a relationship in the Middle East, America's policies, more and more dividing, with a deeper and deeper relationship with Israel and a more and more tenuous one with the Arab world. And in a place which was anyway an earthquake, tectonic plates of political damage and danger and humiliation and fear, when the world's only superpower, as of course America became after the fall of the Soviet Union, effectively takes one side in favor of one side as opposed to another, this is going to open up huge fissures in that society, especially since the Arabs are effectively the Islamic world in that part of the world, the globe.
So having said that, are you surprised that the U.S. really hasn't reassessed its policy toward the Arab world since what happened in September
11th? Under this administration, I think that September 11th has provided the Bush administration with extraordinary opportunities to do things which have absolutely nothing to do with September 11th. I mean, after September 11th, I remember very clearly, I was actually on my way here on September 11th. The plane turned around over the Atlantic. I was on my way from Europe. After September 11th, we never heard about Iraq. We never talked about Saddam Hussein. You didn't. I didn't. We talked about, I was on that plane. I was on the satellite phone from the plane, the plane's aircraft phone. I called my office and they said, we want a story about why you think this happened and who did it. And I said, I'm sure it's bin Laden. I've met bin Laden three times. I felt immediately, I remembered what he used to say to me. And I also thought to myself, we've got to talk about the history of the Middle East in this article. So from that moment, and I also said, many people will try to stop us asking why, because it's a taboo subject. And one thing we never wrote about was Saddam Hussein. It was the last thing he had in our minds. At what point, and I don't know the answer to this, I've been asking university students if they can remember, and I'll ask you if you like, at what point after September 11th, 2001, was the image of Osama bin Laden, which was on all our television screens all the time, all the time, all the time. At what point did it fade away to be replaced by Saddam Hussein?
Right after the majority of the bombing raids in Afghanistan stopped because they couldn't get bin Laden.
Well, I think it lasted a bit longer.
Okay.
You see, at the beginning, they thought maybe they had got bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it moved on. Now, I was told for the first time, it was American academic last night suggested to me that it actually coincided with the start of the big corporate collapses in New York. The major companies. I don't know. I really don't. But I think it was after Christmas. We were still seeing bin Laden's picture at Christmas. But then when Saddam Hussein came up on the screen, television and newspapers in America, and indeed Europe too, we didn't ask why. What's this transition going on in US foreign policy? Why Saddam now? And then there were these tenuous, desperate attempts to link Saddam to bin Laden.
That was now, my next question. Yeah.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I've sat with bin Laden and listened to him cursing Saddam Hussein. He loathes this secular regime of Saddam Hussein. He always has done. And I don't think he was joking. I think he was serious. I mean, I've seen him get... He doesn't shake with anger, but he looks very, very... Well, he's a very sinister guy. And I certainly... The last kind of person that Saddam would want to deal with is someone like an absolutely fanatical, religious, Islamic person like... Or Islamist person like bin Laden. So I don't think there's any connection between Saddam and September 11th, nor do most Americans I talk to, by the way. So we then say, okay, so why do we want to invade Iraq? If he had weapons of mass destruction now, he had them a year ago and 2 years ago. And we go on about, you know, oh, well, we're very concerned about his human rights abuses. Well, he's a monster. Of course he is. But back in 1983, when I was traveling on Iranian trains with soldiers, all of whom had been gassed, who were being taken to hospitals in Tehran, back from the battlefront. I was on the military trains with them, reporting. They were coughing up their lungs because they had gas, and they all died. And I was reporting this. And at that time, President Reagan sent an envoy to Baghdad to arrange to reopen the U.S. Embassy, 1983. And that envoy was Donald Rumsfeld. Now, today, We hear Mr. Rumsfeld going on about the appalling human rights abuses, the use of gas by Saddam, the torture chambers, which were going strong in 83. And yet in 83, Mr. Rumsfeld was shaking hands with Mr. Saddam Hussein. In 84, Rumsfeld met Tariq Aziz, the number two in the Iraqi Ba'ath Party, number two to Saddam, on the very day that the UN published their first report on the use of gas, illegal under all the rules of war, against the Iranian army. This was during the 1980-88 Iran-Iraq war. So I don't really think that this war is about human rights abuses. If it is, why didn't we go to war in 1983 or 1984? When we come to the list of the famous dossier of our own dear Prime Minister, Tony Blair, for example, the 50-page dossier, just 15 pages of that is actually to do with weapons of mass destruction. The other 35 pages are to do with human rights abuses, the history of Iraq and the Gulf War and so on. If you look at those 15 pages, there are photographs, maps. We've seen them in the American press too. And it's quite possible there is something there. But every paragraph in the British document is hedged with the words if, perhaps, could be, probably. To which, as I wrote in my own newspaper, the London Independent, are we going to send the British Army to the deserts of Kutal Amara for if, perhaps, maybe, probably? So I'm not really certain that this has got anything to do with weapons of mass destruction. And I think it's got an awful lot to do with oil, the largest untapped oil reserves in the world. The Bush administration is steeped in the oil business. So many of its administration officials, including the president, have been involved in the oil business. Mm-hmm. I mean, good gracious, Chevron named its a new supertanker Condoleezza Rice the other day. Did you know that?
I heard
amazing,
that.
Amazing, yes.
Yeah.
And I think that the control, which control of the Saudi oil fields and the untapped reserves would allow the United States to control the price of Saudi oil. In fact, it would be a taking over of the whole oil wealth of the Arab world. And that's why many Arabs are worried, much more than they're worried about weapons of mass destruction or human rights, of which they've got pretty little, frankly.
If that's the case, even if the U.S. goes into Iraq and goes against this axis of evil, as the phrase has been used.
That's Bush's phrase.
Right, exactly.
It was written anyway.
If that's the case, if it is all about oil, I'm thinking this isn't going to be settled for a long, long, long time. There are no short answers here, right?
Well, I think if it's about oil, the Americans who are going to have to send their brothers and fathers and sons off to fight in Iraq ought to be told. If they think they're going off to fight for human rights, well, I think that's an illusion. I don't think they're being sent off for that reason at all. Not at all. And, you know, I've been saying, I've been at a number of universities, you know, North Carolina and St. Louis, Washington, St. Louis, Webster and so on, and talking to quite a number of the academic staff there. And they've all been saying, you know, well, we're trying to talk to activists here and academics there and, you know, build bridges and so on. And I said, you know, I hate to say this and it's not my job to say it, but why don't you talk to ordinary people? Why do you keep this in an academic world? Why don't you go out and talk to, you know, it's the truck drivers in America. It's the people who run rail cars. It's bellhops who are going to have their brothers and their fathers sent off to this war. And they should be brought in to discuss it. I mean, they may all think it's about human rights. Fine, if that's what they believe. But there is no real discussion, not in the press, not in television, about this issue. Not in the way that I'm putting it to you now,
right,
for example. You don't hear it, which is one reason why I'm sitting here with you, right?
Well, so, when I talk to those people, you point out the people that I talk to, yeah, they work on the line at our auto plant other facility.
Yeah.
They're ready to go.
Yeah, I know.
Because...
And the president,
they're ready to go
because the president is the commander in chief and they want to be patriotic Americans.
Right.
One of the problems, I think, in this country, and forgive me for being so frank,
that's
why I've come, is that I think that in American journalism, there is an incestuous relationship between newspapers, journalism, and power. Amira Haas, who's perhaps one of the finest journalists in the Middle East, she's an Israeli journalist who lives in Ramallah. She and I had a big discussion in Jerusalem some months ago about the meaning of journalism. What is the real definition? And I waffled on in my English way about how I thought it was about writing the first page of history, which I think it is. That's one of the reasons I'm in the Middle East. After all, I'm actually recording and reporting events that took place because of my father's war, the First World War. She disagreed. Amira is a very shrewd lady. She said, the purpose of journalism is to monitor the centers of power, to challenge governments, especially at moments of crisis. I think that what happens in America is that there's a very cozy relationship between the anchormen, the reporters. You know, you watch CNN or CBS or whatever, and it's always, we're going over now to the State Department correspondent. John, what is the State Department saying? Well, the State Department believes they've become, many of these journalists, a kind of echo chamber, a mouthpiece for power, a fonctionnaire, a functionary, as the French would say. In other words, instead of saying what they actually think is happening, we hear what power wants us to hear, what the forces, le pouvoir, is what the government wants us to hear. And thus, there's no avenue open to a serious, open debate about what really goes on. One of the interesting things is that, I mean, I know quite a lot of the American journalists who operate in the Middle East area. And I chat to them occasionally about, you know, their work and what I'm doing, because we tend to work on our own. And I, funny thing, I always find it much more interesting to listen to them than to read them, because they know much more than they say. And there's a, it's like, you know, it's like in this country, if you question foreign policy at a time of crisis, and you can always have a crisis, if you question foreign policy at times like that, it's as if people might think you are somehow subversive. I don't know if this is a throwback to McCarthyism or whether this is because you're a very young country compared to Europe, for example, where we cynically challenge governments all the time in crisis and out of crisis, and no doubt you will laugh at us for doing so. I'm not sure. And you see, between Europe and America, whereas we would like to pride ourselves on asking these questions, and my goodness, my paper is totally, I mean, editorially, against the war. I was against the Kosovo war, and my paper was for the Kosovo war, but of course, we have this, you know, nobody changes our copy in the Independent in London. It is as we write it, which is one of the wonderful things about working for my paper, and for The Guardian, too. It's the same. I mean, we're not the only paper that does this. But there's this great dichotomy between Europe and America in that the Europeans are asking a lot more serious questions about the possibility of an American adventure in Iraq. And yet, of course, the Americans can turn around and say, well, I seem to remember there was a place called Bosnia. What did you bloody Europeans do about it? You waited for us to come and help out. Can we possibly maintain a ceasefire, a peace process in Northern Ireland without the help of the United States? I don't think there would have been a Good Friday Agreement in Belfast without President Clinton. So you've got this rather difficult situation between journalists who want, like journalists like me, who believe that American journalists don't do their job properly. Unless, of course, they're hunting out in packs after President Clinton because he's lied about a sexual relationship.
Right.
That's a different matter. That's safe territory. Yeah, that's not a taboo subject.
That gets ratings.
Well, yeah. Oh, there'll be ratings out of the Iraq war. I mean, already we've got the TV jingles.
That's right. The power
Showdown
music
in Iraq.
Is out.
They're there already. Yeah.
Power music, power graphics. Before you go, I do want to touch on, since you have talked to Osama bin Laden, I think you used the word sinister earlier in our discussion to describe him. Expand on that, you can. What kind of man is he? Try to paint an image in people's minds.
All right,
the
give me the pricey. I've got 1 minute or two.
you pick.
I'll take three. I've met him three times. The first time in 1993 in Sudan, before he was the monster that he's now obviously clearly being shown as. At that time, I talked to him at great length about the role he played in fighting the Soviet army in Afghanistan. He, remember, was on our side during the war against the Russians in Afghanistan, where he fought very bravely. He was wounded six times. There was one moment there where he told me that a Russian, he'd been attacking a Russian mortar position near Jalalabad in Nangarhar province in Afghanistan, and the Russian mortar shell fell right at his feet. And in the millisecond that he waited to die, he said he felt very calm. He felt a religious feeling come over him. I thought that was very, I was a bit repelled by this. This is dangerous territory, you know. Of course, no doubt to the sorrow of many Americans, that mortar did not explode. Afterwards, he told me that during the period when, just after Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, he went to the Saudi royal family and said, look, I've got my Arab fighters who fought the Russians. Let me liberate Kuwait. I'll deal with the Iraqis. I'll drive them out. And the Saudi royal family said, no, the Americans will do this. You can imagine what bin Laden's reaction was to that as a Wahhabi, Sunni, Muslim, Saudi. And I'm sure that this was a turning point in his attitude, both towards the Saudi regime and towards the Americans. The third time I saw him, which was the second time I saw him in Afghanistan, was in one of his camps high up a mountain. So cold, I remember I spent the night in the camp in a tent with his fighters all armed, you know, and I woke up with ice in my hair. That night, he was much more, had a very sort of chilling self-conviction when he spoke to me. He was very much more firm in his views. And I remember the last words he said to me. He said, Mr. Robert, from this mountain upon which you're sitting, we destroyed the Russian army and helped to destroy the Soviet Union, which up to a point, given a few bits of exaggeration, there was some truth in that. There's some truth in that. But then he said, Mr. Robert, I pray to Almighty God that he permits us to turn America into a shadow of itself. I've got my notes, a shadow of itself. And I tell you, when my plane had turned around over the Atlantic on September 11 and come back to Europe, and I turned on the television, of course, that was my first chance to see the footage out of New York, and I saw the Twin Towers and the falling like that, almost a biblical columns, I remembered, And I those words, and I thought to myself, my goodness, New York is now a shadow of itself. You know, that's why, I mean, that night I actually wrote in the story, these were his words, and now I've seen it. He's a very intelligent man, very shrewd, very ruthless. He'd like, I'm sure, to rule Arabia. He wouldn't call it Saudi Arabia. He wants to get rid of the House of Saud. And believe me, if we think Saudi, the Saudi royal family is strict in religious laws, I hesitate to think what it would be like under Osama bin Laden. Mm. But that, remember, the fall of the House of Saud is more important to him than anything else, more important than America, etc. It's always been the question of getting the ending the Western influence and the royal family in Saudi Arabia, in Arabia. Mm. And it came across in all the three major meetings I had with him. A rather strange man in that when he... Originally, when I saw him, he would be wearing a very ordinary white dish dash, a sort of white Saudi robe with a fairly cheap kufiyeh red hat, or rather a cloth on his head. And he'd wear very cheap plastic sandals on bare feet. I did notice the third time I saw him, he seemed to have a kind of infirmity in one of his feet. I don't know what it was. But later on, after I saw him for the last time, I saw videotapes of him in which he had a kind of gold robe on his shoulders. And I wondered if he wasn't becoming a bit vain. You know, when I would talk to him, he'd sit there, and while I asked questions, he'd clean his teeth with a piece of wood, mishwak wood it's called. Very disconcerting. Imagine being a journalist and the guy talking to you is cleaning his teeth while he's talking, while he's waiting, while he's listening to you, while he's thinking about a reply. One thing I noticed and remembered about him was he was one of the very few Arabs I've ever interviewed who, instead of answering immediately the first thing that came into his head, would think for a whole minute or more what he wanted to reply. Most people, including Westerners, confronted by a mic, we say something quickly unless we look stupid or dumb. We want to say something so we don't look stupid. He didn't care about that. I met his two sons. I took pictures of him with the two sons, who seemed very sort of normal Arab boys. I'm sure they're a bit less than that now, yeah. Or more as the case may be. One of them, of course, got married just over a year ago.
Right.
One of the two I met. He even sent me with one of his armed fighters to look at the three tents in which his three wives lived. I wasn't allowed to meet the wives, of course, in a field with sort of field latrines. It was a very strange sort of situation. And at that time, he still had some contact, even up to 97, with the Saudi royal family. Diplomats were coming from the Saudi embassy in Islamabad to see him in Afghanistan, long after he'd been deprived of his passport and called, you know, the biggest terrorist in the world and so on. So a man, obviously a very intriguing personality and a very sinister, and obviously after September the 11th, what words can you use for bin Laden?
Now, I'm gathering, though, that there must be a charisma to this guy, to the people of the same religious beliefs.
I'll explain it. I've listened to him for hours talking, I mean, sitting 4 feet from him. And the armed men around him, they weren't called Al-Qaeda then, but that was who they were, of course. They would hang upon his every word as if he was a Mahdi, a Messiah. Whether that went to his head or whether he understood, he was a very humble man in the way he talked to his, he always talked about my brothers, you know. He would break off the interview to pray with them outside the tent on the bare ground. I'd stand there and watch. And then when they would have an evening meal, which I was allowed to eat with him, he would just sit among his men. He didn't sit on a high throne or some special cushion. But again, I said later on, after I saw him for the last time, I got the impression there was a kind of vanity coming in there somehow. But yes, the way in which the men would stare at him as he was speaking, the armed men around him, you know, they would talk to me about how they would say Sheikh Osama has these dreams, and he'd tell them what his dreams were. And you know, I've noticed, particularly in Wahhabi Islam, Sufi, that there's this thing about dreams in Islam in which dreams are constantly debated of their importance and their inner meaning. We don't do that. Well, there's a certain fringe in American society that's very interested in dreams, but I'm not very interested. You know, I wake up in the morning and say, that's rubbish, now we get on with the day. But that wasn't the case with him, and unfortunately those dreams turned into nightmares for all of us, didn't they?
Yeah. Do you think they'll ever find him? Do you think they'll ever get him?
Well, I never believed for a moment that he was dead. Because having seen his bodyguards, who are tough, ruthless, vicious, professional men, they would not have allowed him to die in Tora Bora. I've talked to contacts which are impeccable in my eyes. And I believe, and I know I've written, that at Tora Bora, bin Laden wanted to stay behind with other Al-Qaeda men and keep fighting as the shells fell around him and as the bombs came down. And his bodyguards got him out of Tora Bora. Very much, I suspect, as Dick Cheney was hustled out of the White House to the basement by his own security men when they thought there was an aeroplane on its way. Certainly, he got across into Pakistan. Now, what happened after that, I don't know. The famous recording, or infamous recording, the last tape, when it came out, I called up, made a couple of calls to the area of Afghanistan. And my sources, which are absolutely 100%, said, yes, it's him, immediately, and I accept that. However, it wasn't him talking into a tape. He talked into a tape recorder. That tape recorder was then taken in whatever country he was in, we don't know where he was, to a telephone by someone else, who then played the tape down the telephone line to someone else with a tape recorder. So there was no contact between Bin Laden and the communications. It was just a tape recorder talking to a tape recorder. Of course, one thing that Al-Qaeda have learned is you don't go on the telephone when you have American aircraft flying overhead, right? Whether they be manned or unmanned aircraft, which is one reason why his voice sounds so tinny, and also why his voice seems to gabble. And this is purely an assumption on my part. The recorders, I'm certain about, but I think probably one of them had a low battery. And you know what happens if you play a recording on a low battery? When you put it on a proper recording machine on mains power, the voice speeds up an octave, which is why he's gabbling a little bit. I think this is my assumption. This I don't know. The recording machines or tape recorders, I'm certain of. But it was him. Okay, go back to your question. I don't know. I have a kind of feeling, suspicion, and this is based not on sources. This is just my coming out of my head. He might be in Saudi Arabia. He has a huge following in Saudi Arabia. There are people, this will not be acknowledged by the Saudi government, there are people in the royal family, some of the princes, who admire him. I think he might be safe in Saudi Arabia. Indeed, it might be that the Saudis are happy to keep him safe as long as he keeps out of the way and doesn't do anything. But I think, you know, we keep looking at Iraq, we should be looking at Saudi Arabia. It's very fragile. The king is dying in Spain. If the royal family breaks apart, and it's the end of the House of Saud, it doesn't matter how many soldiers are storming into Baghdad, Bin Laden will have won his first war.
From a global perspective, and this will be my final question.
We don't have global perspectives in the Middle East. My crystal ball is broken.
from a perspective outside America, let me phrase it that way. How embarrassing is this for America that the biggest military in the world hasn't been able to get this guy?
Look, the biggest intelligence organization in the world didn't manage to stop September 11. Now the biggest military organization can't get Bin Laden. The biggest embarrassment now, to go back to what we were saying earlier, is that we had Bin Laden on the screen. The administration took him away and put up Saddam. Now Bin Laden's come back, and Bin Laden decided to come back. Yeah, you see, it's his script again. He's writing the script again.